Welcome to the RSGI podcast series for 2025. In it, we will be charting, analysing and revising our six evolutions in the practice of law with the help of some standout legal practitioners and thinkers from around the world. Watch how, in every episode, we revise our concepts and do thought experiments to figure out where the legal industry is going. Welcome to the very first RSGI podcast. I'm delighted to welcome Danny Toby, who is a partner at DLA Piper. Now, we've chosen Danny to be our first guest because he has had two lives. He was originally trained in medicine, so he's kind of a doctor turned lawyer. And he is somebody that has stood out for us in our research for the FT Innovative Lawyers Program. He won the overall Individual Innovative Lawyer Award in 2023, which is one of the hardest awards to win, and has then appeared in our lists winning other awards for other kind of legal expertise and practice areas. Danny represents, I think, the cutting edge of legal practice. I think he represents probably what the new lawyer is going to look like in the future. And I'm very delighted that he is able to join us and share with us all his amazing insights. So a big welcome to you, Danny.
Thank you, Rena. Really, really excited to be on your first podcast.
Tell us a little bit about you.
Yeah, well, so I'm a fifth generation Texan and always thought I would be a lawyer and a writer, a fiction writer. Always loved futuristic fiction, science fiction, and as I got into law school, got very interested in bioethics and biotechnology and the ways that law and technology intersected, especially when that technology challenged the way that our laws had evolved over a longer period. And so I ended up going to medical school as well and have spent almost my entire career working at the intersection of law and technology. I guess the other little tidbit that's informed my perspective is I had a startup software company that, huge cliche, but started in my dorm room in law school and was something I carried with me through medical school and grew a bit of educational software that came out of my own frustration at not being able to take notes and process information the way I wanted to while in real time, and grew that and ultimately was able to exit to Wolters Kluwer, which is a global educational publisher. That has always sort of informed my view of the law because I know what it's like to be the entrepreneur, you know, staying up all night working on the software with friends and then trying to sell it the next day.
So we've got a tech entrepreneur, come doctor, come lawyer. One of the things that I'm interested in looking at, and this is kind of the theme of today's discussion, is we look at the evolutions in the practice of law. So RSGI has put out a report every year looking at all of our research, stuff that we do for the FT and the things that we do for other clients. And we identified sort of six evolutions in the practice of law. And one of them is this idea of going from precedents to predictions. And that's a little bit of the theme of what we're going to be talking about. So one of the things that got us excited was around the idea that you've got, and I know it's still relatively young, but the idea of proactive compliance as a service. So I was wondering whether you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, no, I'd love to. Proactive compliance is really interesting. You know, everybody has this dream that these new large language models can solve new problems, and they can to some extent, but it's not so easy. And there's technological issues and there's ethical issues. Our thesis with proactive compliance is most compliance is reactive. By the time you discover a problem, bad things have already happened, people have already been hurt, laws have already been broken, and you're scrambling to clean up a mess. And the idea is with some of these predictive tools, especially the new predictive tools that can look at not just structured data like receipts and time cards, but now language and subtext and context, we can go much, much earlier and find things before the really bad stuff has already happened. And we're not just doing that by throwing it into a large language model, because we've kind of tested all those tools. And for this very important purpose, they're not where and we as lawyers need them to be. But what we've been doing is training small language models on clients' specific data and on very specific problem sets. So, you know, if a company is worried about a particular sales force or a particular region where they've had some indicia of something, we can train a model that's really sophisticated for that specific problem. And it really increases the predictiveness, but also importantly, the specificity of it, the ability to find real things without finding, you know, false alarms. So I'm very, very proud of that. And our goal, and Rena, you and I have talked about this before, is we're not trying to get after anybody for things that haven't happened yet. You know, I think you have to use this very responsibly and say, we're looking for education moments, moments where things seem to be going off course, where we can step in and say, here's a new control the company can put in place that would safeguard against this drift. Or maybe it's time for a training program or a continuing education program to say, this is not how we do XYZ. And we've tested this with real world scenarios and found some really great things where we were able to intervene. And, you know, the global head of investigations at one of the pilots, the GC said, well, what do you think? They found, you know, 10, say, red flags. And that person said, you know, any one of these could have turned into a multi-million dollar investigation. But now, you know, we can stomp out the embers and no forest fire. And it feels really good.
It's so exciting to us what you're doing, partly because when we started thinking about where is the practice of law going, and we were thinking about it is going more towards predictions. It's partly because we do so much research with clients. We talk to hundreds of GCs every year. And the first time this notion occurred to us was actually probably about 7 or 8 years ago. And we profiled AB InBev and also DBS Bank that year. And what they were saying, and they had legal compliance together. And what they were both saying is that they could predict a potential fraud or a potential breach with about an 80% accuracy. And then obviously that went over the years, that went up to about 90%. And we were thinking, well, if clients are doing this for themselves, it's only a short time until the law firms do it. And so you, the first law firm that we got to know that was doing this in any kind of way at scale, you know, you're actually doing it in a way that could be scaled up. Have you got thoughts about where else you could roll it out to? I mean, we're looking at compliance, but where else could this be applicable, do you think?
Absolutely. So I want to pull on one point you raised, which I think is so important. You know, half of our practice is rolling out the technology tools, but the other half is guiding on the governance of using AI. And I never want to talk about those two things separately, because there is a right way and a wrong way to do this. And it's a technology issue, because there's a lot of sales going on out there where people say, oh, we have this or that tool. And you really have to dig deep and say, like you said, what is the benchmarking? Does it have accuracy? What is the accuracy? Accuracy is not just catching things. It's false positives and false negatives, or, mm-hmm. you know, both of those have harms. It's having good internal governance around these programs. We never do anything that doesn't have a human in the loop. And, you know, you said it was only a matter of time before outside law firms did this. We have a very strong view that there is a benefit to having outside law firms do this, because we will find things that the client may not want direct knowledge of, because they're not helpful and they're distractions. They're false positives. They are irrelevant. They're private. You know, there are things that our human subject matter experts, our investigations counsel, can filter through and say, in our best legal judgment, this is what the company needs to know about. We're not going to burden them with other things that are not material or not relevant. So we always have that human lawyer in the loop. I think that's very important. But
I was just going to say, actually, Danny, because we've bandied around the idea of the minority report, and we're not really talking about that, are we? And I think that's a good point you make. It's actually, we're talking about intelligent predictions, not just absolutes, or intelligent issue spotting.
Intelligent issue spotting, and also building a process and a procedure around that that is responsible AI, that's in line with international standards and expectations for how we use these tools responsibly. Yeah. And also, I think one of the benefits of building these tools inside a law firm is, you know, I've been a startup person, and you know, you're doing a lot, you know, with a little. But we have 4,000 attorneys. You know, if we need an FCPA model in Brazil, we have lawyers in Brazil that do FCPA in Portuguese, and we can build that model with, you know, their decades of legal experience encoded into the model, their cultural experience encoded into the model, their knowledge of a particular company encoded into the model. So there is a way to do this technologically that is a differentiator, because the worst thing you want is to rely on noise that increases complexity. It doesn't decrease complexity. To your question about where else can you roll this out, we've been shocked at the adaptability of what we can do here. Proactive compliance was the original name, but now we're calling it proactive counseling, because we've learned, you know, I do a lot of products liability litigation and sort of the other part of my practice. And, you know, when you litigate one of these multi-billion dollar products liability cases, there are sometimes things that you find. And you know, looking back, you say, gosh, I wish I would have known that, or a company wishes it would have known something earlier. You know, maybe it was little breadcrumbs spread throughout millions of pages in a regulatory file. And what we're learning is we can train these tools to be product liability risk assessment tools. Let's take on a portfolio of products. Let's look for molecular structures. Let's look for journal articles. It's not a magic eight ball. You can't just take all this stuff and throw it into a model and say what comes out the other side. We're working with our product liability litigators, and I'm really proud of them because they just won a big product liability group of the year this week. But you know, their experience is helping us build these models in ways that create signal and not noise, or you know, light but not heat. That's the goal. You want to maximize light, minimize heat. And then nobody wants to live in a world with automatic justice, in my view, and I think most people's view. You know, some people say, oh, these tools will never run autonomously. They're not going to be good enough. I actually disagree. I think they will be good enough, and sooner than we think. The question isn't, could we run a lot of this autonomously? The question is, should we, and do we want to live in that world? So I am actually an optimist in the sense of, I see a symbiosis between human legal caretaking and better and better technology. But I mean, we've now been asked by one client to roll out our proactive counseling into an M&A, mergers and acquisitions scenario. You know, let's bring these tools to do things with deal diligence that literally were not possible before. The ability to sort through unstructured data, you know, communications, articles, documents, contracts, that's what we've unlocked here. This is a next level of sophistication. And, you know, private equity has seen interest in this for risk assessing, for diligencing. We've seen excitement from corporations that want to use it for M&A. And then also just bread and butter compliance and analysis in other areas. Kathleen Brain just joined us. She was a partner at DLA. Then she became the Maryland Insurance Commissioner. And then she came back to DLA. And we worked very closely. She led the committee that wrote the National Association of Insurance Commissioners AI Bulletin. You know, how do you adopt AI in the insurance industry? And she's like, we could use this in the insurance industry to look for insurance regulatory compliance. So we're working with her on that now. So the sky is the limit. I want to stress the key is doing it right. The danger of these tools is because you now can speak to AI in natural language, anyone can very quickly use the out-of-the-box version of these tools and ask it to do things. When we do a project like this, we will run a full-scale experiment with a human team and the technology legal team side by side so that we have baselines where we can compare and know what are we catching, what are we missing, what's right, what's wrong. And we iterate until we get to an acceptable level for us from our perspective and our client's perspective. And last thing I'll say on this one, we're very transparent. You know, the first time we did this, we did a combination of traditional human review. Then we had a narrow machine learning arm. So we built traditional machine learning models. And then we used generative AI. And in those first couple runs, traditional machine learning way outperformed our generative AI. And we knew that because we had a very important human baseline. But we've evolved and we've iterated and we've worked with new technologies and now into the small language models where now our generative AI is performing at a superior level.
I think that's everything you said is so interesting. Just I'm going to unpack it a little bit. So I think one of the things I'm listening to, I'm thinking actually, and I love this term, proactive counseling. Really what we're talking about is perhaps going from precedence, not to predictions, but to proactive counseling. Maybe that's the next, it begins with a P as well. So we've got the alliteration. Marvelous. Thank you for evolving our practice of law evolution. But I think also what you're saying is very key. So I had an event this morning in London. We gathered together 70-odd general counsel in a big kind of roundtable salon. And we were talking about various things. And one of the things, one of the segments of the day was talking about the experience economy. And the GCs were talking about what kind of experience did they want from their outside counsel, from their legal service providers. And they one GC very, very nicely put it and talked about proactivity, that actually in his dream world, he would be having strategic advisors that came to him and said, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? But actually, the golden sort of apex of that proactivity is, and by the way, I've got a business opportunity for you. So it's somebody that actually understands how the company makes money and then enables the company to make more money or to generate more revenues. And as in-house legal teams become more like revenue generators themselves, as well as protectors of the business and guardians of the reputation, they've also got to enable that business. And they're looking for external counsel to be able to do that. So I think it's very interesting that you're seeing it evolve into M&A. And I've been in this business for 30 years. And people often say to me, well, where did you get the idea for innovative lawyers? I got it partly from in the early noughties when I set up my business, talking to loads and loads of GCs who were not happy with their big law firms. And I used to think, you know, how can this industry continue to exist when these big clients are not getting the service that they want? And even then in the early noughties, what they wanted was this proactive service, was this you law firm come to me, you law firm tell me what I don't know in a way about things that I need to know about. So I do wonder, as we're thinking about, you know, the overall practice of law, you know, we talked about this a little bit before, but, you know, what does it mean to know your client? And in a funny sort of way, you're taking your client's data, obviously in a safe, protected way, you're running Gen AI over it. You're helping them know themselves better than they know themselves, if you see what I mean. Where do you see that extrapolating to? You know, let's talk science fiction. Where are we? Where does that client-lawyer relationship go to?
I love that question because one of the greatest legal lessons I ever learned. When I first came to DLA, I was going to give a presentation to a client, and it was titled Risk Mitigation for AI. And Lauren Brown, who's one of our vice chairs, looked at the deck and he said, I love it. I only have one suggestion. He said, cross out risk mitigation and call it business enablement. And that was one of those career moments where a light bulb lit off. That changed my entire perspective to lawyering. And now I'm in this really fortunate position where I'm not just working with general counsels, I'm working with boards and C-suites, the CEOs, the CIOs, the CTOs, the CISOs. And I love it. I absolutely love it because, you're not just saying, how do we avoid risk? You're saying, how do we navigate the future and build value for our company and our customers and our shareholders? And part of the question of how do you build value is, how do you avoid potholes? And then I think the other key thing is, AI is almost like the canary in the coal mine to me of where the legal profession goes, because you can't approach AI as a lawyer as a risk issue. And you can't approach it as a legal issue because it is the most horizontal technology on earth. It cuts across, it's basically just software, like it's software 2.0. So we say artificial intelligence, we're really just saying the next generation of software. And that touches every aspect of an enterprise. So when you get hired now, it's counterproductive if you're just coming in 2 weeks before a product launch and the legal department is saying, oh my God, they're gonna launch this large language model. What could go wrong? Can you test it? Can you do this? We do that all the time. I mean, it's a what not to do in terms of project design, but it happens. You know, we get brought in. Our large language model is about to launch to 100 million people. Can you come in and test it? And so we have data scientists inside the practice. Some of them are lawyers, some are, you know, lawyer data scientists, some are data scientists. We come in, we do that testing under privilege to battle test it. But that's not the ideal. The ideal is day one of the project, the CEO, the CTO, the CISO, the CPO, the GC, they're all working together through their lines of authority to say, how do we build the most successful product? If you have everyone breaking down silos and saying, here's our budget up front for testing, here is the set of guardrails we want to put at from the very beginning, so we don't end up in a situation where someone is trying to say no later, because we've done our best to say, what's the right way to go? And then let's go a million miles an hour. That's the way to go fast. So I love that, you know, 2 years ago, I would get hired by lawyers and general counsels. And now, you know, I spend as much time talking to boards and C-suites, including the general counsel. And it's so collaborative. It's so value-oriented. And that's what lawyers ought to bring to the table. Because eventually, we can plug in a question into a computer and it'll tell us what section XYZ says. That is an area that is eventually going to be automated, but this creative value proposition, I think, is where it goes. And part of value is predicting and engineering around the highest areas of hitting a brick wall. That's what I love doing.
You know, this point you make about this these generative AI being software. And it being a new software, I saw a very interesting presentation from a chap called Ben Evans last night. Actually, it was shared with me by the GC of Bridgewater, which I thought was very timely. But they were talking, he had one slide where he was talking about how people used to view an elevator. We never think about a lift, as we call it in Britain, or an elevator as a, you know, as a piece of AI or software. But there it was, you know, back then it was. And I think that's absolutely right. It will become part of our tools that we won't sort of notice.
Can I say one thing about that?
Yeah, sure.
Because I think that's a brilliant point. I mean, you know, there is this joke that AI is whatever we haven't invented yet. And it just becomes software or technology. And you know, you think about like an elevator, no one says, you know, oh my gosh, that's artificial strength. It lifts people up, you know, 20 stories, and gosh, now humans are no longer the masters of strength. And no, we still have like powerlifting in the Olympics. But I will say this, because this is something I feel very passionately about.
Yeah.
While there is an evolution in technology and it's a matter of degree, and yes, aspects of AI will become part of the fabric of daily life, there is something different about it. And it's a little bit boiling the frog. You can't quite say when it got really hot, but it did, one degree at a time. There are enough cumulative developments with AI where key aspects of predictability, control, understanding, moral decision-making, it's not just business as usual. It does get to more and more complicated and judgment-laden tasks like agency, autonomy. So I think it is very appropriate that we're being cautious as a society, because, you know, elevators blend into the background and you don't think about them. But when autonomous justice or autonomous healthcare blends into the background, there are some things that you want to make sure they're going right before you just assume them as part of the fabric. And that is very important.
Yes, it's back to your human in the loop point. You know, I mean, there are all these studies that show that actually judgments done by an AI are often less biased than a human judge. But actually, it's that issue of compassion. Do you want to be judged by the AI? Or do you want to be judged by the human? And maybe it's the two things together. That's the way forward. I started off this conversation sort of saying, probably going to terrify everybody by saying you are the lawyer of the future. And we're not really saying that the lawyer of the future has to be a tech entrepreneur, a budding sci-fi writer, published sci-fi writer, doctor, then lawyer. But we are talking about a different kind of mindset for people to come into the law and for young lawyers. You know, what would you advise a young lawyer? You know, what do you think they need to have to be successful in this world?
Yeah, I think young lawyers have an inherent advantage compared to some other professions. You know, on one hand, we're quite vulnerable to technology, to the newest technology. I mean, you look at some of the charts that say, you know, the legal profession is high up in what large language models will eventually be able to do. But lawyers are also very, very flexible and adaptable. I mean, you think about the way we're trained, we're given hypotheticals and they're thrown at us and they're changed in real time and we have to jump left or right. And they say, okay, well, what if the car is blue, not green? Does that matter? And, you know, it's this constant training of adaptability and flexibility. And those will be the skill sets of the future for lawyers. But I think in addition to that, really broadening what a legal education is. I mean, we have to understand more about business and finance. We have to understand more about technology. We also need to understand the humanities because, as you said, there will be a symbiosis between human touch and software. And we have to be really good at the human touch. But I will say a note of optimism, because you do talk about, you know, people getting scared. I always think about the pandemic. You know, the pandemic proved that we could do business through video conference like we're doing now. But I fly more and do more face-to-face post-pandemic than I did pre-pandemic. Why? There is an ineffable human need for connection that will continue to exist. And we should be happy about that. As much as I, you know, sometimes I wish I weren't on a plane, that's a good thing. And it shows that as a human species, we have a human meaning and role. And that's very, very important. People say their fear is that AI becomes more like people. And I always say my biggest fear is that people become more like AI. You know, it's polishing off that humanity and grace and dignity and compassion. We're going to need those skill sets more than ever.
Well, thinking about humanity and humanistic views, a couple of last questions for you then, Danny. You're an inspirational guy. So where do you get your inspiration? Tell us, you know, the most inspiring book that you've read in the last 12, 24 months or so.
Oh, gosh. I just finished Never Let Me Go, which is a bit of an older book, but I absolutely loved it.
That's great. So Never Let Me Go, and who's that by?
Ishiguro.
Oh, great. Well, that's going on my reading list. And the very last question. So music that inspires you.
Oh, gosh. So my trinity of musical loves is opera, the Beatles, and Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan, I was just thinking about his quote from When the Deal Goes Down. He says, we live and we die and we know not why, but I'll be with you when the deal goes down. And I thought that's just he always cuts to what matters, even when we don't know anything.
Well, that is fantastic. Listen, Danny, thank you so much for joining me. That's a wonderful note on which to end. And thank you very much.
Oh, thanks for having me. This is a lot of fun.